más porque la podía. Tú no puedes hacerme eso que pensará mi familia. No puedes abandonarme después que te di mi vida. No digas que no me quieres, como antes sí me quería. La última vez que se vieron, ella lo mandó llamar, cariño del alma mía. Tú no te puedes casar, no decías que me amabas, que era cuestión de esperar. No sabía que estaba armada y la muerte muy cerquita de la bolsa de su abrigo. Sacó una escuadra cortita, con ella le dio 6 tiros. Luego se mató Laurita.
Corridos. Shop on Mexican work and leisure in the St. John's River Basin. And what we'd really like is to get questions from the audience about what we'll be discussing. And I'm going to introduce the people that are here. You've probably seen them around the campground, camp festival ground. This is, on my left is Vicky Grimm, who is demonstrating piñata making. And Maria Castillo, who is helping out with the food waste section. And also Sonia Ortiz, who is helping out and demonstrating how to make tortillas, flour tortillas and corn tortillas, which are two of the basic foodstuff of Mexican culture and probably the food that is most recognizable to North Americans from some, you know, fast food restaurants like Taco Bell and Taco John's, where you can buy burritos and tacos made, you know, from the tortillas, which is like a Mexican bread. Okay, one of the things that we'd like to talk about is what the Mexican population in the St. John's River Basin does for their occupation and why so many Mexican people have come into that area and settled. Okay, the St. John's River is approximately 100 miles east of here. And in the southern part of the river, near the biggest town being Deland, from Deland to Crescent City North, which is about a 50-mile zone, there's a large fern industry that has taken root in the area in the last, well, it's actually been there for about 50 years, but in the last 20 years or so, the ferneries have grown bigger as the citrus production has decreased due to the change in the temperatures, especially the bad winters and freezes that they've had. And I'm going to ask Maria to start out, and I'm going to just ask her some questions about what it's like to work in ferns. Does everybody, you know what house ferns look like, houseplant ferns? Okay, you might tell them some of the names of the ferns that you work with.
Well, we have quite a bit of fern, you know, in the fern business. We have the leather leaf, and we have the plumosa. We have the spring rice, we have the tree fern, and we have so many more that I'm not very familiar. I know it, but, you know, I don't know the names of them, and I didn't know we had that many until we started working, you know, in this, in the fern business. I thought it was only one kind of a fern, but I have, you know, learned that there are so many, and we have work all year round. Every day.
Do you know how do they get a fern plant started?
Well, it just goes on and on, you know. Replant and replant, you know, from the same plants.
You take cuttings from the fern?
Right.
And replant them? Okay.
Right.
And what does it take to keep a fern plant alive?
Well, a lot of fertilizer and a lot of water, a lot of attention, really.
Okay. Why do you think that the ferns survived better in the winter than the orange trees? Has anybody figured that out?
Well, maybe because it's water, you know, all through the, when it's freezing, they have it covered, and that ice protects the leather leaf. Mm-hmm. They keep the water running all the time.
The leatherly fern is the fern that we're probably all the most familiar with. It's a sturdier looking plant than, what's the plumosa?
Plumosa.
Mm-hmm. It's the kind of misty looking, I don't know the botanical names for it, but it's the fine, almost like, you know, what do they call that? They're not shaped like a regular fern plant. I mean, it's real wispy. I guess that's the best way to think of it. They're the kind that come in wedding sprays when you get bouquets in flower shops. Okay, that's the plumosa. The leather leaf is the traditional fern, the tougher kind of fern. That's why they call it leather leaf, I think, because it originally was the first fern that was planted in the area. The fern industry came from someone who came from Connecticut down to the area in Pearson and, you know, experimented and just tried out the first plant in their front yard. And then from there, when they realized that that was a really good area, because ferns, one of the people that I talked to in the area said that you could grow ferns in construction sand. It doesn't need a healthy, you know, fertilized sand. It'll grow. They'll grow in almost anything. The most important element is keeping them wet, irrigated. And like Maria said, in the wintertime, the water, when it freezes, it actually protects some of the ferns, especially the tougher varieties such as the leatherleaf, so that the fern industry doesn't suffer the losses that the citrus industry was suffering with these bad winters.
Have you ever worked in ferns?
Never.
No, I never cut any for her at all.
Sonia, ¿usted trabaja en el helecho?
Yes,
papa. ¿En la hierba? Okay, Sonia's learning English, but she doesn't feel comfortable enough to speak in English, so I'm going to talk through an interpreter and ask her about what a typical day in the fernery would be like.
Si podemos hablar sobre un día típico, ¿no? Trabajando en la hierba. ¿A qué hora se levanta? ¿Cómo se corta? ¿Cuántas plantitas se pone en el ramo? Cosas así. ¿Se puede hablar? ¿Cómo fue ahora la época del Día de la Madre?
Oh, con mucho trabajo, ¿verdad? ¿Desde qué hora se entraba?
¿Ah?
¿A qué hora se entraba?
A las 7, a las 8.
They get up, you know, start the day in the morning around 5 or 6 and fix their breakfast and their lunch also. And then they're off to work, you know, around 7 or 8, and that's all day long. And let me ask her how many bunches she cuts a day.
¿Cuántos corta al día? ¿Cuántos manojos?
Okay, she cuts 300 bunches a day of leather leaf. And that's 25 sprays to a bunch.
Okay, a spray is one leaf. Uh-huh. You know, one fern leaf.
Okay, and then she gets paid 20 cents a bunch. And then you multiply that times 300. So she makes, you know, real good. And that's our busiest, you know, season. It's at Mother's Day, you know, big holidays like that. And otherwise, you know, it's always, you know, hard work and every day. And that's every day, like in those seasons, like Mother's Day and holidays, we have to work all through Saturday and Sunday. But then after that, it slows down and we just work, you know, from Monday to Friday and not as many hours.
Yeah, the biggest holidays for the ferns, because of the what they call the decorative green industry, the florist shops, and the last minute flowers that you wire off to your mother when you've forgotten to buy her a Mother's Day present. If you'll notice, most bouquets, they do contain some fern, some of the leather and the plumosa, the real, the wispy kind. That's all I can think of explaining it. And the main holidays for production are Valentine's Day, Easter, and Mother's Day. But Mother's Day really is the peak holiday. And they have people working, 7 days a week, as Maria said. And could you explain how you cut the fern?
Yes. At first, when we start coming to Florida, we didn't even know anything about the fern business. And they gave us a whole bunch of, a big bag of rubber bands and clippers. And we didn't know where, to put the rubber bands or how to get the clippers. We thought we needed an extra hand, because we had to put a whole bunch of rubber bands, in our arm. And then the clippers in the other hand. So we figured that, and we had a whole, you hold the bunch with this hand and also the rubber bands go in this hand, arm. And then with this other, you cut, the sprays. So we thought we were short on one hand, We needed somebody to hold the bunches for us. But no, as time goes on, you manage and you learn real fast. And then you don't know which kind of sprays to put because there's some the young ones. And then the ones that we are supposed to, the green ones, the darker green ones are the ones we're supposed to cut. But it's amazing, we didn't know that everybody needs so much fern all over the world because we live in Pearson, and that's the world's, the fern capital of the world. So we make quite a bit. My husband and I have crews working, and his crew cuts 6,000 bunches a day, and so does mine. And then our company has 5 or 6 crews working every day, so we didn't know. What did they do to all this leather leaf? But it's all, all over the world.
I think you know something about exportation. You were telling me about where the fern is sold.
Oh, there is many places where they ship all over the world. Some of this fern goes to Europe and to take care of the supplies over there. Because it's the only place the fern grows, so most of the fern that is seen over Europe and other places, it comes from Florida.
Yeah, I don't think very many people in Florida are aware of the fern industry over near the St. John's, and it's estimated to generate about $70 million a year for this, that business. And it's certainly a growing business because a lot of people, they say you can start your own fernery with 1 or 2 acres. Is that right, Maria?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And probably an investment of about $10,000 or $15,000. So there's a lot of people out there starting small ferneries and with just a few acres. I mean, when they talk about a big grower, how many acres would you say they have?
Well, gee, I don't know. This company we work for have a whole bunch of acres, and we don't get to work in the same fernery until about every 2 months. So, and then with the 5 crews that they have, they must have quite a acres. I never have asked them, how many, but and then it keeps growing because out of one plant you could replant, and it just adds on and on,
Vicki Grimm is here demonstrating how to make piñatas, and I thought we could ask her some questions about how you go about making a piñata. When is a piñata appropriate? At what kind of a celebration?
Well, those piñatas are appropriate around Christmas, and nowadays are very popular in birthdays.
Everybody walk away.
In Mexico, we always had them around Christmas, but as the years had gone by, the piñata has become a very popular entertainment for birthdays and parties and special occasions.
How are the piñatas different in Mexico than the ones that we're seeing here today?
The piñatas in Mexico are usually made with a clay pot. And they are usually made by families, not bought.
And how do you make one with a clay pot? I mean,
well, you just get your clay pot and you decorate it with tissue paper, which has been curled up, and create your own shape or form that you want.
So the clay pot is like the paper mache ball that you make, that you're demonstrating? Yeah,
exactly,
over here?
Exactly. It's the same thing.
And is it always so dangerous to break a piñata?
Well, it's not really dangerous unless you get out right underneath the guy that's swinging the bat. Most of the time, a piñata, if you get scratches and bruises, you're doing pretty good, but it's a lot of fun, to be honest.
I've got a question. How do you choose the person that gets to take a turn to hit the piñata, try to hit the piñata? We were having some problems with that. In Mexico,
you usually go by sizes. You put the youngest ones first, and as they go up in height, that's how they go taking turns. And you try to put the piñata a little bit high enough so that you go ahead and work your heights on the children.
Well, what about some of the poor children that can't get to the candy? Or even some, it seems like the person that breaks a piñata, since they're blindfolded, by the time they get the blindfold off, it's too late and the candy's all gone. What, do they get anything?
Usually in Mexico, you always set aside some fruit or some candy for those ones that cannot get into the piñata. And we always have little baskets filled with candies for those ones that cannot get anything. And that's how you solve the problem of somebody else is not getting anything. You always set some aside for those ones who didn't get any.
Well, we'll have to do that. Sonia, ¿cómo usted ve que la comida en Florida mexicana es distinta de la comida en México? ¿Hay algunas costumbres que se han cambiado o trayendo la comida de allá? Pues, ¿es igual más o menos?
I'm asking
her if she's noticed that if there's any changes between the way the Mexican food that's consumed in Florida and the Mexican food that she'd be used to in Mexico.
Sí, se me hace que es igual.
Porque me parecía que mucha gente come tortillas de harina en Pearson. En esa zona, en vez de hacer tortillas de maíz como caseras o que se compran en paquetes.
Sí, muchos usan mejor la maseca que comprar de esas de paquete.
We're talking about how in Mexico you usually have tortilla factories where you can buy fresh dough or you can get the tortillas already made, you know, out like that. So, of course, when a migrant community comes in and you have an immigrant population, they don't have the same facilities for food, so they have to make their own. And it's a long process. It's time consuming and it's hot, you know, on a hot stove to make tortillas by hand. You can see this being done in the food shelter. And it seems that there's more of a changeover for people eating flour tortillas instead of corn tortillas, at least the ones that they make by hand, because it's easier to make flour tortillas than corn tortillas.
No, I have to differentiate that it's easier to make corn tortillas than it is to make flour tortillas. To me.
For you.
Because when you make a flour tortilla, all you got to do is squash it down in the tortilla press. When you have a flour tortilla, you have to roll the flour tortilla a lot longer than you can squash down one with corn. Isn't that so, Maria?
Yes, but I'd rather make the flour.
How you use a tortilla press.
She's a northerner. I'm a southerner.
Thank you.
Florida, actually, you grew up in Newberry, but moved to Hastings, what, about 30 years ago, Buck, or 20?
About 27 years ago.
About 27 years ago. And Buck has been playing blues ever since he was about 13, a long time. ago, I guess. Not that long. Started learning out from learning from his father, and later picked some things up from folks he just met along the way. And he's also, I guess, played with some rhythm and blues bands in the 50s for a while and picked up a lot of songs from records and just from playing in clubs. And maybe we'll start out with a couple of the older style songs and then move into some of the more popular style. How does that sound to you? Anything you want to start out with, maybe Red River or whatever, okay.
Which way? Which way? Do that blood red river run? Will it run for my mind? No, mama, do it run for the sun? Oh, God, oh, God, now your crying won't be a mistake. Will it mow your cry before you drive me?
That we used to play all the time when I was small.
Yeah.
Tell us what to.
Hey, hey, hey.
while I'm a crawling king snake. And I rule my den. As I'm a crawling king snake, and I rule my den. Come on and give me what I want. I won't crawl no more. Well, I caught you crawling now, baby. I'ma crawl up in your door. You gave me what I want. God knows that I won't crawl no more. Now love your baby. I'm a crawling cage day, and I rule my den. Come on and give me what I want. I won't crawl no more.
Let me see.